Solomon and his wisdom. We have talked about Solomon and his desire to build God a temple. We have talked about the great sacrifices that Solomon made before that and the sacrifices he made during the opening of the temple. And we've spoken of him in pretty glowing terms. And we've seen that he is the wisest, most blessed, and maybe most well-known leader of his day. But yet the most unfortunate part is there's more to that story. Some of you are not old enough to remember Paul Harvey because you don't listen to the radio like people my age and older did. But Paul Harvey used to tell the thing, "Now you know the rest of the story." And he would spend 5 or 10 minutes, it seemed like, I was all the way to school, giving the story, and then he'd give the guy at the very end who had invented that or who had accomplished something. And if we were doing Solomon's story, we would start with these glowing reviews. And we would see how wise and how smart and how intelligent and how gifted and all of the good stuff that Solomon did, but then we would have to know the rest of the story. And it's interesting that there are lots of kids that are named David. I don't know too many kids that are named Solomon. So for those parents who are looking at verses from the Bible to say, "I want to name my child after some great character in the Bible," they're going to choose David over Solomon almost every single time. And it's interesting that the reason is probably because Solomon's heart turns. Because the story does not end as well as it begins. So I want to end Solomon's story. We're not done talking about Solomon yet, but I want to go to the end of his story. So this is chapter 11. The Lord became angry with Solomon. You might circle this part, because his heart had turned away from the Lord, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant, for the sake of Jerusalem, whom I have chosen." Okay, that's not a very good last paragraph on Solomon's life. Solomon had it all. We're going to refer to Ecclesiastes in a couple of sermons, but in the opening of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is basically going to say this in the first three chapters: "I had it all, and I tried it all, and I got some more, and I tried some more, and I kept trying, and I kept trying, and I kept trying." And yet Solomon failed miserably. And one of the things I've wrestled with, maybe out of Solomon's life more than anything else, is he has so much abundance. And abundance is something maybe quietly we all yearn for, right? I mean, don't you like it when it's the end of the month and you've got a little more money in the checking account than you had the month before? Don't you like it when you can pay off your car 2 months early? Don't you like it when you get a raise or when you go to do your taxes and you're going to get maybe a refund? And you see that and you think, "Well, I got an extra $100 or I got this or I found that 20 in my pocket that I had left a long time ago and didn't realize what I had done with it." This idea of abundance is something that Solomon has gotten more than plenty of. But a line from studying this week has really kind of haunted me. Material success can often be accompanied by spiritual decay. It seems that we live in this little American dream thing, and the American dream is you show how good you are by the job you have and by the raise that you get and by the way you move from here to here to here and what neighborhood you live in and what car you drive and what school your kids go to, and we fill in a bunch of blanks that say, "Well, I am just a little bit more successful now than I was last year or 5 years ago or 20 years ago." But one of the things I've seen in standing in this same little spot for so long now is that prosperity may be a greater test than adversity. Here's what I mean by that. I have seen way, that's going to be awful grammar, but I'm going to say it like I mean it. I have seen way more people, that's the bad grammar part, sorry English teachers, fall from their relationship with God because of much than I have because of trouble. Because the American dream says, well, look what I have done. Look at what I have earned. Look at the house that I've bought. Look at the cars in my garage. Look at the diploma on my wall. Look at my position within the company. Look at. And usually in all of those moments when we say, look at, it's not look at what God has done. It's look at what I've accomplished. Out of all the people I've sat with on their deathbed, only one has said, my stuff brought me closer to God. And if I'm being totally transparent, I think he was lying through his teeth. What I have seen when I've been sitting on those deathbed conversations, whether they're in hospitals or whether they're in homes or whether they're in nursing facilities or wherever they are, is I sure wished I would have spent a little more time with my kids. Or I sure wished I wouldn't have been so intent on making money. Or I sure wish. And what I'd like us to learn from Solomon is I don't want to have those end-of-life feelings that say, I sure wished I would have been a little more attentive to A, B, C, and D. I want to live that life now. Because what happens is when I start becoming attentive to A, B, C, and D and not God, it starts to bring spiritual erosion. Okay, you know what I mean by erosion? If you go up in the mountains, you see a little bit of erosion. You know, it rains and the water starts coming off that mountain, and it starts with maybe a little trickle as it's working its way down to wherever it's going to get. And then it rains more, it erodes a little bit more, and then it erodes a little bit more. And if you've been to Ruidoso any time in the last year, you would see it eroded enough to wipe out homes and stuff. Now, it didn't start that way, but that's what happens spiritually. Is when I start living this American dream that revolves around me and what I've accomplished and what I can do, it starts distancing me more and more from God because it's more about me and less about Him. And it is unintended and often it is unnoticed. And before we know it, where we were with God and where we are with God are completely different. And Solomon is a prime example of that. Remember, Solomon is the young king, gets the blank check. And God says, Solomon, what do you want? And Solomon says, I want wisdom to lead and guide these people that you blessed me with. And God gives him that, but slowly Solomon moves out of an environment where God is the center to where it's all about him. And I don't want us to go down that same road. And I don't want to go down that same road. Solomon's going to do a couple of things. And the things that Solomon is going to do are going to help turn his heart. And you remember that phrase was kind of haunting to me in chapter 11 where it says Solomon's heart had turned. Now, his heart turned slowly, but his heart turned. The first reason it turned is because he started to make unnecessary alliances. So if you go back to chapter 3, and we focused a lot on chapter 3, because chapter 3 is one of the great moments in Solomon's life, but there is this early verse before he starts doing some cool stuff that reads like this: Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. Now God had kind of told the Israelites, don't marry the other people. You stay within your tribe. You marry your people. And so Israel is now this world power on the scene, and Pharaoh wants an alliance. That Solomon has got wealth, and he's got riches, and he's got David's army behind him, and they may be, at this point in time, the greatest nation on the earth, and Egypt wants a little piece of that, and they want to make sure they're on the right side. And so this conversation starts between Pharaoh and Solomon, and the Bible doesn't give the conversation, but my guess is it goes kind of like this. Hey, why don't you give me a little bit of yours, and I'll give you a little bit of mine. And here's my daughter. It's an alliance he's going to make. To Solomon, I'm not sure this is an act of love in him saying, well, that lady from Egypt, she is a looker, and I can't wait to spend the rest of my life with her. I think it is, this is the right thing to do. From a foreign policy state. That if I marry her and if I bring in this alliance, then the other great nation in the world at that time, we're going to be friends because we're married together. And he's going to trust in the flesh to realize and rationalize what needs to be done. Trusting in the flesh usually gets me in trouble every single time. How about you? When I go from the wisdom I think that God has given me, and I quit running things through the lens of the gospel and what God has said through his word, and I start running things through the lens of what I want the most in my life, I tend to make the wrong decisions. And what Solomon does is he sees the woman from Egypt and he says, we can make an alliance, and I'm seeing this from a purely earthly standpoint. We can be friends, and therefore I don't got to be afraid that Pharaoh's going to come invade us. And so Solomon does it. He wants peace. He wants happiness. If you want something bad enough, you can convince yourself that it's something God also wants. I remember, I tried to quit telling stories about Jonah, but I can't help this one. Jonah really wanted a particular thing one year for his birthday. And so the little particular thing was out of our price range, and his father had no intention of buying that for him. But he wanted, and I remember him looking at me in the car after I'd picked him up at school, and he said, God wants me to have that. And I said, baloney, God does not want you to have a little skateboard scooter thing. You know that's got a battery and that powers itself. You don't need that. I don't think that was God's idea. Solomon convinced himself that God wanted him to be happy. There's a reason he's going to marry a whole bunch of women, and it's not because he falls in love over and over and over. It's because he just wants to meet his needs. The second thing that happens is Solomon has some unhealthy influence. Okay, same chapter, 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 2. Again, we talked about this a little bit. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Okay, if we go back into our understanding of what goes on with Israel coming into the Canaanite land, God says clearly, do not worship at the high places. Over and over, he tells Israel, you get rid of the Canaanite places of worship. So the Canaanites, what they would do is they would find a place that was higher than everything else, and that would be the place they would go to offer their sacrifices to Baal or Molech or whatever other Canaanite gods they're serving. And God is going to look at them and he's going to say, we're going to have a place called a tabernacle at the beginning, and that's the place we're going to go to worship. We're not going to go to this hill that was built in honor of this god. And what Solomon does is Solomon goes back to the high place. Now what Solomon does is he makes a huge sacrifice to God. We talked about that. And it's not to some Canaanite god, it's to the God of Israel. But evidently what Israel does is they use all of the high places as their destinations for their worship. And it's going to be a trap that gets them falling in love with other gods. So Israel would go to the high places, partly because they had no temple, but partly because they saw Solomon do it. Now when Solomon did it, it was worship to God. But when they're doing it, they're going up, and suddenly they're being convinced by the other Canaanite things that are going on there that maybe this God is all right. One of the sad things about Solomon is he gets all of those women from all of those different places, and he will build places for them to go and worship. Not temples, not a place to go worship the God of Israel, but a place to go worship their God. And so what Solomon does is he gets around this influence, and he gets around these women and probably men too, and he's going to the places like this, and before you know it, you slowly start to be affected, and the influence is bad. I remember as a very young preacher, I listened to one preacher every single Monday morning. And he was a preacher from Texas with a twang, and he dropped the G's on his words, and he did everything in this kind of logical do-do-do-do-do-do. And I found myself almost imitating him because I thought, well, this guy's so much better than I am. And that might have been a good influence. But have you watched it sometimes with your kids? Maybe they get around that kid in the neighborhood that's not the best kid, And instead of taking the kid in the neighborhood and making that kid better, your kid starts to look a little bit more like the neighborhood kid. Influence is a huge thing. Then Solomon's got a trouble with this guy named Hiram. We call it unresolved conflict. When David was king, he had this buddy that ran Tyre and Sidon, which are two cities on the coast, and his name was King Hiram. And King Hiram had provided all kinds of stuff for David, and there was a pretty good relationship between David and Hiram. And so Solomon calls Hiram when he's about to build the temple and to build his palace, and he says, "I need some stuff." Let's read a little bit of this conversation. So we get to 1 Kings chapter 9, and at the end of 20 years, during which Solomon built these two buildings, the temple of the Lord and his royal palace. We'll talk about that more in a second. King Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre, because Hiram had supplied him with all the cedar and juniper and gold he wanted. But when Hiram went from Tyre to see the towns that Solomon had given him, he was not pleased. "What kind of towns are these that you have given me, my brother?" And he asked, and he called them the land of Kabul. Okay, nobody here probably knows what Kabul means. Kabul in Hebrew means ripoff. Okay, you have built the temple to your God that's got all kinds of wood and even more gold in it. And on top of that, you have built this huge place where you and all your women probably live. And I've given you the wood for that, and I've given you the gold from that, and I've given you all the material for that. And here's what you've done. You have ripped me off. He's callous. He's all about him. So even though he's made this deal that he'll give 20 cities to Hiram, even though he's made this deal and this handshake and this agreement between the two, he is careless about a horizontal relationship. Okay, I've noticed anytime there is some horizontal relationships that are cattywampus, usually there's a vertical relationship that's out of whack too. Does that make sense? If I am at war with you, and if you and I are having trouble, and maybe it's husband and wife, or it's parents and kids, or it's two people in the same church building that don't agree of how we should do things, when we start having this war with each other and this callousness toward each other, it almost every single time has a significant impact on the relationship with God. So when the horizontal is off, when we're having this callous relationship with each other, and to be honest, we don't care a flip about the guy on the other side of the street, which is Solomon and Hiram. That even though the guy on the other side of the street fulfilled his end of the bargain, Solomon kind of thumbs his nose at Hiram and says, "Here you go, have these." And how often has our callousness done the same thing? And when that callousness with a spouse, or that callousness with a parent or a child, or that callousness with a brother or a sister in Christ, or a coworker, or fill in all of those blanks, when those relationships start to go awry because it's all about me, I almost am willing to guarantee we've got a problem going between us and God too. So Solomon's got this unresolved conflict. And then Solomon has a problem with unrestrained extravagance. Okay, one of the things that bothers me the most about Solomon, first is all the women, because I can't fathom that. I mean, I have trouble handling one, and he's got about 1,000 when you put them all together. It takes him 7 years to build the temple. I'd say let's play Bible trivia and see if you know. Anybody know how long it took to build the palace? Almost twice as long. Okay, what does that say? Now, granted, the temple is pretty simple. The temple is building with a building and a building and a room and a room and a room and a few altars and a bunch of space around it. So pretty simple to build. It takes him 13 years to build his palace. 1 Kings 9 reads like this. Here is the account of the forced labor King Solomon conscripted. So tell me, how does Solomon build the temple? How does Solomon build his palace? He taxes the hound out of people, and he brings in a bunch of slaves. And it is extravagant. Okay, one of the things I have wrestled with the most. is how do you preach the gospel to the richest culture in the world? I don't know if we're the richest culture in the world. We're the richest culture that I know of. How do you tell the story of leave everything, take your cross, and follow me? How do you tell people who've got great jobs and people who've got food on the table and people who aren't worried about tomorrow and who have retirement nest eggs and who have everything lined up for the rest of their life and some, how do you tell them that they've got to have Jesus? Because the world that we live in doesn't necessarily say we've got to have Jesus. It says we've got to have us and we've got to do well and be well and prepare well and save well and have all of those things. And in doing all of that American dream stuff, we may totally lose sight of what God has said through His Son. Okay, the American church, and I'm going to be broad, the American church is being pounded right now. It is losing a growth rate, they say, of 2 to 3% a year. And that has been happening for a decade and a half. So for at least 15 years, the big scope, the people who would claim to be Christians, that number is dropping by 2 or 3% every single year. Which tells me the gospel works in places like Africa, where it's exploding. The gospel works in places like the Middle East, where it is underground and exploding. The gospel works in China, where the gospel is illegal, and they do it underground and under trees and in closets. And there are more missionaries ready to go over the border of China as soon as the Chinese president says Christianity's all right than there is in America in the suburbs where we've got it made. How do you preach the gospel to people who think they already have it all? Solomon had it all. And what happens is when Solomon has it all, he gets caught up in the all and loses the most important thing. I don't want you to lose the most important thing. And I don't want you to become so calloused that you don't see it. And I don't want you to slowly erode and move a step away and then move a step away and then move a step away. And before you know it, here's where you were. And then 20 years later, you barely have a relationship with God. I don't think that's the way God designed it. But that's what happens far too often. In the world where we have plenty, let's not lose sight of the one who gave it to us in the first place. So what we're going to do is we're going to call you to change if you need to. If you're struggling with that, if you feel like your spiritual life is slowly eroding and instead of growing stronger every year, you're going the other direction, then we want you to do something about it. To find somebody who can help you with your walk, to find somebody who can hold you accountable, to find somebody who'll say, okay, we're going to study the Bible every Thursday at the library. Maybe you need a staff member. Maybe you need an elder to pray over you and help you through some spiritual erosion. But don't get to the spot where you look back like Solomon does. Okay, a verse we're going to use in a few weeks is at the end of Ecclesiastes, after Solomon has gone on and on and on about vanity and chasing after the wind, he's going to say, here's the one thing that matters. I've seen it all, I've tried it all, I've done it all. He didn't say this part, but he even bought the t-shirt. And he's going to say, the one thing that matters is fear God and do what He says. I don't want you to be on a deathbed to figure out to fear God and do what He says. I think it'll make our lives actually better if we practice it now. So if you need something, I'm here at the front. Elders will be at every door. If you need us, come. Bryce, let's sing.